It's Ellie.
This civic group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening, my name is Zoe and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given a 5 and 1 minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker tonight is Dawn H.
I'm Dawn and I'm an alcoholic and I'm glad to be here. Good to be sober. I want to thank Marty for asking me to participate. It's always, it's a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you for that. And I'd like to welcome the people that are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. We only wish you well. That's what I heard. I hope you'll find what I found is a way to live sober comfortably most of the time anyway, but not have to take anything, to change the way I feel from the inside. And, I think I needed something, from the gate. My earliest memories as a kid are just to feel different and apart from, and, if somebody would have told me I was dropped into that family, I would have believed it because I didn't feel like I fit in my own family. And I come from a good family. My parents sent us to Catholic schools, and I got in trouble, with the nuns from the start, and I began to run around with a group of girls that, they labeled us the tribe, and we broke all the rules, and around, 12, 13, we started to, ditch school, and we would go and, get the parents' liquor cabinet first, and then it graduated into, we'd walk around, and, and this is in the 1960s, you could hang out in front of the liquor store, and anybody would buy you, if it didn't matter, a guy would buy you alcohol. So, I loved the effects produced by alcohol from the very start. It changed, everything about me. I was no longer too tall, too skinny. My hair, my teeth were perfectly straight, and, I felt wonderful. And I couldn't wait to drink every, chance that I got. An example, when I went to this party my first, year in high school, and like the first few weeks, I knew one person who the party was at her parents' house. And, I'm this like really a shy kind of person. I enter that room and I immediately see a guy in a sailor uniform. And I know he can get alcohol. And I go up to him, I don't know him. And then me and him are going to the liquor store and we're buying, a bunch of booze. I'm already, worried about my supply. So I'm hiding a couple bottles out under this old, abandoned car in the backyard of this house. And the last thing I remember is going to get, a bottle. I think it was at Brew 102. It was big bottles of beer they used to have. And the next thing I remember after that is that I'm in a bedroom with a dog trying to bite me. And in retrospect, I know my drinking never got any more successful than that, but I kept working at it. I was the kid who was hung out across the street at the wall in the morning before school with the kids that are smoking and drinking and doing all the things you're not supposed to be doing. And somehow I got out of school and I tried to go to college and, I was just aimless. And I got, I was involved with this guy that I had, one idea of how things were going to be, and he had quite another. And, you know, he would tell me, well, you need to get a job making more money. So I did get a job making more money, but, through a series of events, that relationship ended. And so I'm working at this company now, and that was in July 1978. And a few months into that, my supervisor, took me into a conference room, and she told me that she saw me, she would see me coming to work, as she described it, green. And by this time, at first my drinking, I had a large capacity, I could drink people under the table. And then, I started getting those horrendous hangovers and throwing up that yellow bile. And I would just, I was sick, and I'd have to wait till I could choke, get something to drink to start to feel better. And she, she told me her story. I did not know it, but she was a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember, I just looked down. I couldn't even make eye contact with her. And she told me, her story and her solution, and that she had found a way, to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she asked me to go to a meeting with her, and I really did not want to go to that meeting, but I wanted to keep my job. So I went with her. It was Friday night, Dunsmore, La Crescenta. And podium participation, and people are all getting up there, sharing, their experience, strength, and hope. And I could tell that, these people knew, they knew about drinking, but my overwhelming feeling was, don't they know any better than to keep that stuff to themselves? You don't talk about those type of things in public. And so, I told her what, she wanted to hear. And I went about my business, and the way I operate at that point is that, if attention is drawn to my drinking, I just get out of the way. I, move on. And so I, that's exactly what I did at that point. I, transferred out of there, transferred to downtown LA. Now I have I have those bars that you can drink in. I go to lunch. I don't come back. And, my behavior is just getting more and more out of control. I, I can't predict my behavior, and I'm in blackouts, and, I'm coming to in places I don't know. I've lost track of time. So my way to control it is I'm just going to drink at home. And, my home is just this dingy apartment with standing water in the shower, no sheets on the bed anymore, all those type of things. But I did have this woman's number. I didn't work for her anymore. But at some point, as I'm sitting there, 26 years old, wanting to die on a daily basis, I called her. And I went, I started to go back to meetings. I didn't stay sober right away. It was probably the better part of a year that I, went in and out and, went drunk or whatever the case. But, I finally had a moment of clarity. On November 29th, 1981 is the date of my last drink. And, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Slowly I got involved. I got, a sponsor and started to take direction. I worked the steps. And I spent most of my early sobriety at the Triangle Club in Pomona with people like John and Alberta Keefe. And, it was a great foundation because they were crazy people, but they, liked having fun, but they were serious also about, being sober. And eventually I moved, I've been south. Everything I have is just a result of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to be a good employee. I learned how to be a good member of my family. I repaired relationship with my parents and, learned how to be a good friend and eventually a good wife. And, I was able to, be there for my parents at the end of their lives. And, and that, was, you know, if that was all that I got was to repair that, it would have been worth it. But, you know, I've been given so much more. And, you know, I'm just super grateful to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a, you know, a good home, a sober home. I have everything I need and much more because I learned to, you know, turn my eyes outward and ask you what was going on with you and what I can do to help you. And that's changed my life. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our second 10-minute speaker is Jonathan G.
Hello, my name is Jonathan and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank Marty for asking me to participate in my recovery, to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. You know, I get a little nervous, and when I get nervous, the thoughts in my head move a lot faster than my mouth could operate. That's not necessarily the case when I get angry. Sometimes my mouth moves a lot faster than I could process my thoughts, and it gets me into trouble. And I don't plan on getting in trouble tonight. We'll see where this goes. I'd like to welcome the newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new. I'd like for you to at least hear this. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the first couple meetings, the thing I heard was the importance of identifying and how to do that, how to listen to stories and take little pieces of it to kind of make your own story out of that. Hopefully you hear something that you could identify with. It all started for me back in Clearwater, Florida. It's a little beach town in Florida, off the Gulf Coast. I grew up in a fairly normal family. My dad worked, he worked hard for us to put food on the table, and my mom, she stayed home and raised three boys. I was the oldest of three boys. And, you know, she stayed home raising us until we were old enough to not burn the house down. And I probably almost burned the house down a couple times after she left. I think my first addiction was playing with fire and kind of hiding. I'd get home from school and underneath the bathroom sink, there was hairspray and rubbing alcohol, and I'd go in there and light it on fire. I was afraid of my dad growing up. Not that he was abusive in any way, but, you know, I just didn't like his direction. You know, one of the first resentments I really had was against him. Because when I finally found a group of friends that accepted me and wanted me around, he didn't want me hanging around them. He wanted me to, you know, stick to the books and to go to church on Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. And that's not what I wanted to do. So that got me in a lot of trouble. You know, I butted heads with him. Before my first drink, I was the kind of guy that got, kind of picked on and bullied. I didn't like being messed with. And I think people knew that, and they would mess with me. And then I would be the one that got in trouble when I retaliated. I remember in elementary school, I hit some kid with a lunchbox. I think he had that coming. In middle school, some kid was flicking me in the back of the ears, and I just dealt with it long enough until, you know, I turned around and knocked the wind out of him. It turns out he had asthma, and I got suspended for a week because of that. I just don't know how to handle problems, you know. Remember my first drunk? I chugged a bunch of vodka. I don't remember what happened. I woke up in someone else's bed covered in my own vomit. Had a head-splitting headache and thought, when could I do that again? You know, I dropped out of school before I could be a fifth-year senior. They had an opportunity for me to be to walk with my class. I was falling behind in my grades. I wasn't even going to my night classes, which I was supposed to be going to. I had had a car. So all I wanted to do was drive around town with my friends and smoke pot. You know, it was easier to get that than alcohol at the time. My parents used to have friends over, and they made alcohol look fun and attractive. They had friends, and because I wasn't allowed to go hang out with my friends, I couldn't wait to move out so I could have friends over and drink beer like they were. But I didn't really drink like they did. I remember a couple times telling my dad how hungover I was, and he's like, John, I can't believe you drink like that. I got a DUI in a company car. You know, I was underage. You know, that's kind of when that first pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization kind of, you know, hit me, you know, having to face up to my parents. And the person that I worked for was my mom's best friend, so it was really embarrassing. Life became hard after that. I went back to the job that I was working, making pizzas. And, you know, I got in trouble with that job, you know, because I was underage and alcohol was still hard to find for me. You know, drugs, you know, I was introduced to drugs, and I wasn't able to show up to work on time. I wasn't a good employee because of that. And they let me go before I moved out to Colorado, which was my first geographic. And I gave them maybe four-week notice before I left because I'd worked for them for a long time and I thought we had a good relationship. And that would be enough time for me to save up money for this trip, but they fired me before that. And I had to sell everything I owned. I went on this trip with these two girls and my friend Joe. These girls were like, yeah, let's go on a road trip. We're going to stop in every major city on the way out and see the nightlife, and then you guys could fly back. And he comes to me and goes, let's just move. So we sold everything we owned. I moved out there with a duffel bag full of clothes and a couple hundred dollars in my pocket. I got a job bussing tables. And they kicked us out after about a month and a half of living with them. They were calling us bums and stuff like that. And I get home from work one day and I look in the breezeway and my friend Joe smoking a cigarette says, hey, guess what? We're homeless. And I look around the corner and all of our bags are packed. And I said, let's go to the bar and get hammered. You know, that's how I handled that. I had money in my pocket. I was in a new city. I wasn't going to let anything stop me. And we did that for about 5 days. I had a sleeping bag. I slept in it at night because I had a job, and he slept there during the day. After about 5 days, he couldn't handle that anymore. And I went back to work with sticks and leaves in my hair. And people were like, you know, my boss, I was running late. And they're like, you better have a good excuse for this. And I did. I told him I was homeless. People that I worked with were kind enough because they saw I was a good kid and they saw that I worked hard to offer me a place to sleep. Some of them said things like, why didn't you say anything? And my thought was, I'm the new guy. You know, I'm not going to just come and ask for this. But that kind of changed. I, you know, started expecting a place to stay. Places the first year I lived there. Working in restaurants, working in bars. So there's definitely alcohol to rely on. I was in this new city. That's how I made friends. On the way to work one day, I got hit by a car. I was on a skateboard. Yeah, it was mid-afternoon, and that really messed me up. I flew about 9 feet in the air and had to do physical therapy 3 days a week for about 6 months. There was a lot of drugs involved with that, prescription drugs. I definitely didn't follow the prescription. Definitely had a bottle of whiskey with those pills. And then when I got that settlement money, I spent it all at the bars and with friends. I had nothing to show for that. You know, this whole time that I was in Colorado for 10 years, I didn't really have a good relationship with my family. I never really called on them. But I didn't ask for anything. You know, I always went home on holiday and, you know, put on a good face. I guess I never called them when things were bad, but I also never called them when things were good. But when I was there, I led them to believe that things were good. And they were for the most part. Until things started to plateau. This is where my alcoholism really started to kick off. I was losing jobs. Employers were saying things to me like, what's wrong with you? And I would say things like, you want a smaller list? What's not wrong with me? You know, I just felt like a glutton for punishment at this point in my life. I was hit by a car last year, April 15th of 2019. Very, very slow accident, but it affected me in a way. I was like, I wasn't able to work. And I kind of didn't want to work anymore. I was tired of people. You know, I was a bartender at this point, and I, you know, how dare these people come in and see me? They're helping me pay my bills, and I was just so resentful towards them. 1 minute left. Holy crap. I was in a very bad spot. I was in a very small corner. had nobody good in my corner. I had no good early direction. I started selling. I became my best customer. I was very scared of the actions that I was doing and where it was going to lead me. I trusted in my dealer who told me about the Midnight Mission. I went to the Midnight Mission and he told me to do everything they told me to do. I got a job. And at the Midnight Mission, they gave me a job. But the whole time I'm there, I'm thinking, you know, after 3 months, I'm going to go home and resume my normal life. But to get out of Skid Row, I started going to meetings. There was a van that took me to Pacific Group, and I started listening and I started identifying. And I started doing the steps with a sponsor. Things started falling into place. These coincidences just kept happening. Good things just kept coming because I was taking the action to do the right thing. I know I'm sober today because of divine intervention and because of working the steps and because of the examples in this home group. Thank you for letting me share.
And speaker tonight is Dean A.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Dean. I'm an alcoholic. Great to be here. Thank you, Zoe. Thank you so much, Marty, for asking me to speak tonight. What an honor and a privilege it is to be here. And also, special shout out to the 10-minute speakers. Jonathan, when I heard you talk about chugging vodka, puking all over yourself, waking up in a stranger's bed and wanting to do it again, I thought, I am definitely in the right room. And also to Dawn, just sharing about coming from a good family. I had just mentioned to my wife earlier tonight, I always felt like my story was slightly different because I had come from a good family. And when I first got to AA, I heard, oh, I came from an alcoholic, abusive family. And I had a hard time relating. So welcome to the newcomers. We are really glad that you're here. Welcome to Plan B, as I always love to say. You know what? I'm going to be looking at you, Zoe, because you're demonstrative and I need to see somebody smiling and laughing. So feel free to laugh and smile as much as you want. For the newcomers, you know, there's so much we can do for the new person here. We can excitedly show you all the cool Zoom meetings we go to. We can get you commitments at the Zoom meeting, you know, be a greeter or a cupcake person or a treasurer. We can tell you what pages to read out of the big book, introduce you to people you might get along with. But the one thing, you guys, that we can't do for the newcomer is make the newcomer willing. The way that we become willing in this program is drinking enough alcohol and getting beat up enough to come into these meetings and say, help me. I cannot do this thing called life on my own, help me. And at least for me, my story, that didn't happen as soon as I got here. It took a long time for me to understand that fact. Also, I just wanted to mention, I am one of those kind of people. I love Zoom meetings. My home group, by the way, is the 9 a.m. Stay Connected Daily. That's 7 days a week. Zoom meeting, and a lot of our people are here tonight, so thanks so much. We are well represented. Matter of fact, that's how I got to know Marty and Julie both. So, excuse me. I always like to say, you know, in World War II, the soldiers had to go overseas, and they could not make Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and they created the Grapevine. And I feel like so too with our worldwide pandemic going on right now. It's going to take a lot more than a worldwide pandemic to prevent us alcoholics from getting together and sharing our experience, strength, and hope. So I love Zoom meetings. And if you're new, don't let anybody tell you that you cannot stay sober on Zoom meetings. We have several new people in our Zoom meeting, our home group, and they have been sober. They got sober on the Zoom meetings. So language of the heart comes out loud and clear on broadband. So, it's good to be here. Oh, my very first Zoom meeting I wanted to mention. My first Zoom meeting was about 2 years ago. 2 years ago, my first Zoom meeting. And it was a very early Sunday morning meeting, like 5:30 in the morning. And it was called the Portland Eye Openers meeting. And I spoke at it. My wife spoke at it. By the way, my wife, Debbie, will be sharing her story next week. So you get to hear the rebuttal. She'll tell you the truth about some of these things I talk about. But anyway, so the very first meeting I went to on Zoom was 2 years ago. And after the meeting, we looked at each other and I said, you know, it's okay, but why in the world would you go to a Zoom meeting if you don't have to? If there's real in-person meetings available, why would you go to a Zoom meeting? I mean, I get it if you live at the North Pole and there's no meetings available. But today, I have completely done a 360 and I love Zoom meetings. So really glad to be here. I want to tell just one real quick story about Clancy. Excuse me. Condolences to the family and friends and sponsees of Clancy, which is like every single person in this meeting. The first time I heard Clancy speak, I don't think I mentioned my sponsor. Perry C. is my sponsor. I think he's here tonight. Hang on, I'm going to check all 192 pages and see if he's here. No, just kidding. My sponsor's Perry C. My home group is a Stay Connected 9 a.m. meeting. And my sobriety date is March 10th, 1992. So the first time I heard Clancy, I was about a year sober at the 502 Club in Covina, California, the Friday night speaker meeting. Clancy gets up there and shares from the podium. And the girl sitting next to me, a newcomer girl like me, newcomer guy, she gets up when Clancy starts to speak. And she goes to get a cup of coffee. And Clancy calls her out and says something along the lines of, get coffee during the coffee break. And if you just sit down and shut up, maybe you'd hear something. I mean, I'm sure that's not what he really said, but that's what I heard. And then he paused and Clancy said, the reason why I do that is it's more important that you stay than it is that you like me. And it rocked my soul. My head exploded because I had never heard anything like that. And I realized this guy loves Alcoholics Anonymous so much, he doesn't care what people think about him. He just wants us to stay in these meetings. And I had a lot of respect for him. And to me, I never heard anybody in my life share that understood the disease better than Clancy. So anyway, enough about that. You know, my story, I was born and raised in a small town called Carmel, Indiana. It was small back then. It's real big today. That's why I like the fact that you mentioned, Don, that you came from a good family. My family, my upbringing was totally idyllic. I had a mother and father that loved me, two brothers and two sisters. My dad's way of showing love was to have a nice car in the driveway and clothes on our back and a nice house to live in. You know, he didn't say the I love yous, but I felt loved and nurtured, and it was a wonderful childhood. And when I was about 13, 14 years old, my best friend Keith and I were on our bicycles, and we found this lake that we stumbled upon, and the lake had a rope swing that we'd swing out, and we'd go swimming in this lake, our own little private little watering hole that we discovered. And the next day, Keith wanted to go back to it, and I couldn't go because we had a family commitment. So Keith called up our other friend, Steve, and they went together. And that day, you know what? I mixed up the name. Steve was my best friend, and he called Keith. Anyway, so Steve had a hold of the rope swing, and when he swung out, he didn't let go for whatever reason. And when he swung back, his body slammed into the trunk of the tree, and Keith ran down and half pulled him out of the water, and he ran to get help. And when Keith returned, Steve had slipped down in the water and drowned. And I always felt like it was my fault because I wasn't there to save Steve's life. And I never, ever talked about that. And I don't even know if that was a conscious feeling, but I always felt it was my fault. 2 years later, my idol in my life, my big brother, who was my hero, he was bigger, stronger, faster, smarter, because he was my big brother. He was really just about my best friend. We were real close. We did a lot together. And he contracted Crohn's disease. And it seemed like about 2 days later, he passed away. I'm sure it wasn't 2 days. It was probably 2 weeks. But just like that, I'd lost my best friend and my big brother within a space of a couple years. And the reason why I tell that story is because at that time in my life, I'm a 16-year-old kid, and I gave up on the game of life. And I gave up on God. I didn't stop believing in God, but I felt like if that's the kind of God that's out there that will take away my best friend and my big brother, I want nothing to do with him. And shortly thereafter, I had my first drink. And I personally believe I'm one of those alcoholics that crossed an invisible line. And the reason why I say that is when I went off to college, I joined a fraternity. And my line changed about the amount of alcohol I drank, from how little to how much. So in other words, I would have two or three beers the night before, and the next morning I'd say, oh, I had 12 beers last night. And eventually somewhere along that line, I had 16 beers last night, and the next morning I'd said, oh, I only had a couple. So I believe I'm an alcoholic that crossed an invisible line there somewhere. So I also love to say about my, I joined a fraternity. I'm an 18-year-old kid, real innocent, skinny, super naive, pimples, big ears, didn't know anything about anything. And I always love to say about my college fraternity experience, at any given time, my GPA was inversely proportionate to my blood alcohol level. So as each semester progressed, my GPA fell in inverse proportion to my blood alcohol level. And eventually after three semesters, alcohol became just a lot more important, and partying was way more important. And that school was Indiana University, by the way. So I came to sunny Southern California, 19 and a half years old, 20 years old, because I had a couple sisters that lived out here. And to me, the party was on. I moved to Pasadena. Shout out to one of my best friends, Pat S. is on this meeting tonight. We go back, let me do the math here. We go back 41 years, you guys. We go back to drinking on fake IDs. And he's sober a few months longer than I am. Anyway, a lot of crazy stories about that guy. And I fell into this crowd in Pasadena of young men that looked at life the way that I did. And that life revolved around alcohol, chasing girls, playing poker, throwing darts, and just the typical bachelor kind of lifestyle. A small handful of young men that looked at life the way that I did. And that life, you know, we'd go into Hollywood and go to the clubs, and we would do the things that young single guys do, you know. And eventually, you guys, eventually I would walk into that room of my very best friends in the world, those young men that I just told you about, my best friends in the world. Pat's one of them. And I'd walk into that room full of my very best friends in the world and be all alone and empty on the inside. And I think that's a feeling that every alcoholic in this room probably can relate to, especially when we're new, and oftentimes even as we have some time in the program. So anyway, I would love to sit here and tell you that I knew right away at that point that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, but and I ran off and joined AA, but that's not my story. I kept drinking. First time I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got busted for drunk driving in Hollywood. I'm 20 years old. I wasn't even 21 yet, and I got court ordered to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you guys, I hated everything about it. I couldn't relate. Got my court card, sat in the back room, my arms folded, never once raised my hand and said, my name's Dean, I'm an alcoholic, never once got a sponsor, never got a big book, nothing like that. I just got the court card signed and left, and I'm sure I went home and drank, or I stopped at the bar on the way home. Anyway, 7 years later, another drunk driving, busted again, court ordered to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still hated everything about it. Fast forward to March of 1992. In Rancho Cucamonga, California. And as I mentioned earlier, I've got two sisters, and the one sister came to me in March of 1992 and said, our oldest sister, Chris, has a problem. And I remember saying, what's the problem? Is it heart disease, brain cancer? What is it? And she said, well, we can't talk about it right now, but be at my house tomorrow at noon and we'll go over it. So I showed up at her house the next day at noon. We got in her car. She had a Bible on the center console, and we're not a particularly religious family. And we drove in this eerie, awkward silence, and we pulled up to a little house in Pomona, California, with a sign on the front door. And the sign said, Serenity House, Alcohol and Drug Rehabilitation Center. And I got this feeling in the pit of my stomach, uh-oh, the jig is up, and this is about me. And I walked up those little wooden steps. It's funny now, huh, Zoe? It wasn't funny at the time, but it's funny now. So I walked up these little wooden steps, walked through what used to be the kitchen, walked through what used to be the living room. And in that living room, there's a big circle of chairs with family and friends in that big circle of chairs, and an empty chair in the middle. And the empty chair in the middle was for guess who? I sat down, and everybody had this clipboard, and they all went around the room. It was a well-orchestrated, planned-out event, and every person said something along the lines of this: if you wish to continue living the life you're living, I want nothing to do with you. However, if you want to get clean and sober, I'll do whatever I can to help you out. And the feeling I got in that room at that point in time, you guys, was, oh my God, if every single person in this room thinks that Dean has a problem with drugs and alcohol, then I guess it's me that doesn't see it. I'd never been able to make that connection before. If you had hooked me up to a lie detector test an hour before, I would have told you drugs and alcohol smooth out life's problems. Alcohol makes life bearable. Alcohol is not the problem. I know that for a fact because I've tried quitting on my own several times, and life did not get easier. It got worse. I was uncomfortable in my own skin when I wasn't drinking. The judge was after me, cops, nobody respected me. My girlfriend didn't understand me. My boss was always on my back. I never had enough money. Life was tough. It's cold, dark, and lonely, sober. And when I drank, everything was okay. So at that point in time, in that intervention, I got it. And I realized later what really happened in that moment was God gave me the grace to see the truth about myself, and I'd never been able to make that connection. So I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on my own free will. I went on to my first AA meeting voluntarily, and I raised my hand and I said those words, "My name's Dean, I'm an alcoholic." And I don't know if I'm the only person in this room that had this feeling, but when I said those words for the first time, it was sort of like a weight came off my shoulder. And it was a weight I'd never known I had carried because I had no frame of reference. And I want to tell you about that very first meeting I went to on my own free will without a court card. First meeting I walked into voluntarily. I walked up to what looked like a secretary because he had a clipboard and he looked official or whatever. And I asked this secretary looking guy, I said, "Where's the sign up sheet?" And he goes, "Oh, we don't have one here." And I said, "Well, how will you know that I'm here?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Because we can see you." And I just could not wrap my brain around the fact that you would just go to a meeting on your own. I mean, to me, AA was a punishment, something that you had to do because you were court ordered. But here I was walking into an AA meeting on my own volition. And at that point in time, you guys, March of 1992, I did kind of like the only thing I knew what to do. I felt like, okay, I'm not drinking, problem solved. You know, I've got 4 days sobriety or 6 days or whatever it was. And I'm going to AA. And I found her, you know, the first her. I don't know if any guys in this meeting can relate to her. But I found her, and we moved in together, we got engaged, and we started this little walk of death, you know. And, oh, I got to mention, though, I got a sponsor, I had a few commitments, and I worked the first 5 steps, and that newcomer and I made it to 15 months together, which is unbelievable. Two newcomers together, 15 months, that's like 15 years in regular people time. But anyway, we made it 15 months without murdering each other and without drinking. And long story short, I totaled my car with her in it. I smashed through a streetlight in Rancho Cucamonga. And the streetlight falls over my car and missed me by a couple inches, missed killing her by a couple feet. And I look over and she's disappeared. She's vanished. And a few minutes later, I don't know how much time went by, but, you know, cops are there and fire trucks and sirens. And she shows up with my sponsee. And I'm thinking, oh. Okay, well, I guess everybody in town knew that they were together except me. And long story short, in this little teeny window of opportunity, 15 months sober, I lost my girl, I lost my fiance, I lost my car, I lost my job, and I lost the place I lived in, all in this wonderful little window of opportunity, 15 months sober. And I ended up crumpled up in the fetal position, choking on my own snot and my own tears. And that's when I stammered out those magic three little words that you hear every now and then in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was, God help me. And I realized at that point in time, you guys, that this had nothing to do with a rum and coke or a Corona or a shot of tequila. What this had to do with at that point in time were these feelings I had inside of me, feelings of unmanageability. I wanted to kill somebody, maybe that guy, that sponsee, maybe that girl, my fiance, maybe me, I don't know, but somebody's going down. And I had all these, just this anger and this self-pity and this loneliness. And thank God I had 15 months sobriety. I'd gone to AA enough to remember when your ass falls off, you pick up that 900-pound phone and you call somebody. And I did that. I picked up the 900-pound phone. I called my sponsor and he came over and we made a pot of coffee and we talked about it. And for the first time in my life, this really stands out to me, because for the first time in my life, I walked through unpleasant, uncomfortable feelings without having to cover them up, without having to drink or drug or do anything but just feel the feelings. And it was so uncomfortable and awkward for me, because I thought the point of life was to avoid uncomfortable feelings at all costs. But what I did at that point in time was I got close to a handful of men that were sober and knew a lot more about living life on life's terms than I did. And these men had walked through relationship breakups, totaling cars, losing jobs, losing houses. And not only did they not have to drink over that stuff, but these men had dignity and integrity about themselves. And that's exactly what I wanted. So I redoubled my efforts. I'm going to meetings still, and I'm getting more commitments, and I'm listening to my sponsor now. And I started hearing things I'd never heard. You know, one of the problems when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous was the solutions that you guys were offering didn't match my problems. You know, my problems were I needed money. I needed my girlfriend to understand me. I needed the judge off my back. And I needed my boss to give me a break. And you guys would say things like, well, get a big book and work the steps, get a sponsor, get a commitment at the Friday night meeting. And I'm thinking, none of those solutions are matching my problems. None of that stuff makes sense. I'd be glad to do that stuff once I get my life together. But I'm not gonna go to meetings when I've got all this stuff to do and try to get my life arranged. So my life was upside down. And it took me getting beat up enough to understand that there is another way. And that deep down inside, at that point in time, I fully conceded to my innermost self that I really was an alcoholic, even though I'd been going to meetings for 15 months and raising my hand. So, you know, the other thing I heard was doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth, disease of alcoholism is a disease of a twofold nature, the physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And that physical allergy totally made sense to me. Once I got a shot or two of alcohol in my system, it set up a craving that differentiates me from the non-alcoholic person. That made sense. I got it. Okay, I get it. That's why I'm not supposed to drink. However, before I pick up that very first drink, I'm stone cold sober. What's going to get me to pick up that very first drink is the mental obsession. This time it's going to be different. I'm not the same guy I was back then. Surely I know better. You know what? I'll just drink at home. I'm not going to go out and cause problems. You know, all those mental obsessions, this time it'll be different. That's what's going to get me to pick up the first drink. And by working the steps and doing the spiritual principles that you guys had suggested, the big book, going to meetings, getting a sponsor, getting commitments, I got it. And it finally started to make sense. And I also realized, oh, that's why they said don't get in a relationship the first year of sobriety. And I realized to myself, you know what? It was my decisions. Excuse me. It was my decisions based on self that caused these problems. Now I get it. If I hadn't gotten in a relationship, if I'd listened to them, I wouldn't be in this situation right now. And I finally started to understand it. So another man said to me, the problem with a guy like me, the problem I have with working the steps, getting commitments, talking to my sponsor, going to meetings, reading the big book, the problem I have with that stuff is I want to get better my way. I want to recover my way, so I get the credit for it. And he said, that's a really insecure person. Instead of getting better somebody else's way, they get the credit for it. And that sunk in also. So skip ahead here. 10 years sober. I'm still going to meetings, doing the deal. 10 years sober. I meet another. Are you ready for this, guys? I meet another her. I don't know if any of the guys can mention to a second her. That's right, Jonathan. Another her. And this one was sober like, I don't know, 9 months or something, maybe a year, somewhere around there. Actually, she had a year. She was sober a year. But, and I had 10 years, and she went out and drank while we're together. And so she moved out. And I kind of stayed friends with her a little bit. Like maybe I'd pick her up and take her to a meeting. We weren't really dating per se, but you know, we're staying in touch. And she'd get 6 months and she'd go out, you know, and then she'd get a year and she'd go out, that little dance of death thing, you know. And eventually one night I get a call from her. She's at work. She's drunk again. And she asked me to come and get her. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to come and get you this time. I'm going to call some women that maybe can. So I called some women and I couldn't get a hold of anybody. So the next morning I find out that night at her work, she hung herself. And I don't know how that makes anybody in this meeting feel, but I'll tell you how it makes me feel. She wanted this thing called sobriety. She wanted it. She tried to get sober. But at the 502 Club, where I got sober in Covina, we had a saying, while we're sitting in these meetings getting sober, the disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups, you know. And I'd love to say I walked hand in hand with the spirit of the universe through all that stuff, but I was in a deep, dark, unhappy place for several days. But you guys pulled me through. You know, I had a buddy of mine come over from AA, and I remember sitting at the little kitchen table in this place, and this is what he said to me. He doesn't even remember saying this, but it was about 48 hours after she'd taken her life. And he said, Dean, normal people don't take their lives because they don't have a ride home from work. And I got it. It was just that simple little statement that kind of set me free. And I realized, yeah, he's right. He's right. So fast forward to 16 years ago, 2004, 16 years ago, I'm at Seal Beach. Another good friend of mine, Mike R. And I had a tradition every week. I'd go to Mike's house and we'd hang out together. We'd do a barbecue and we'd walk to the Monday night Seal Beach meeting. Some of you may have been there. So that night, Mike's out and back barbecuing. And I hear this at the front door. I don't know if you guys heard that or not. It's supposed to be a knocker. And I go and answer the door and there's this young woman and she says, oh, it's Kelly here. Now it's Mike's wife. I said, well, no, Kelly's not here, but it's third inning. Dodgers are up 3-2 if you want to come in and watch the game. She didn't want to watch the game. She left in a huff. Anyway, that's how I met my wife now. And, you know, we started dating. We went to some meetings together. We started dating. We dated for a year. I asked her to marry me. We got married a year later. We had an AA wedding in Las Vegas. It was family and AA people. And, you know, I need to say one of my biggest fears was having a long-term, continuous, monogamous relationship. I did not know how to do that stuff. A long-term, continuous, monogamous relationship based on respect, love, and compassion. I had no idea how to do that. But I'd been to enough AA meetings and listened to the men and the women share about their relationships and how God comes first. And as long as you put the program first, and you do the deal, all the rest seems to fall in place. And our relationship, you know, they used to say when I first got sober, things like, you know, you're going to live a life wilder than your wildest dreams. And I would think to myself, you know, I can dream some pretty wild stuff, man. I don't know about that. But the life I've had since I got sober has been unbelievable. I used to share in meetings that my story is a little bit different because I am the guy who has had problems in recovery. You know, deaths and bankruptcies and just a lot of pain and suffering, but I just didn't drink. And I kept coming back, you know, even when I wanted to, I just didn't drink. And I always kept going to meetings and I always stayed in touch with my sponsor. And anyway, our life took off. We've been happily married for 14 years now. I've known her for 16 years. And the things we have done, what do I have left? About 7 minutes or so, I think. I know I'll get the 5 minute beep. So, we were able to go to Europe on our honeymoon. And while we were in Europe, we got to go to AA meetings all over the place, in London and Germany and Lithuania and Spain. And we had the time of our life. And when you're in a foreign country or even a different city and you don't know anybody, you go to an AA meeting and you have instant friends. These people showed us how to get on the subway, the cool coffee shops in town. And we had the time of our life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And AA is alive and well in Europe. There's probably somebody here tonight from Europe. Anyway, the things that we have done in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to share the last few minutes about what it's like today. A couple things we've done. We actually were fortunate enough. We got to be a part of the Bill W. and Dr. Bob play, and we got to travel being actors in the Bill W. and Dr. Bob play. And we did it in several states in Western California and had the time of our life. It was a real honor and a privilege. That means 5 minutes to say. So, when the pandemic hit, you guys, back in March, my wife is a school teacher. She teaches second graders. And by trade, I'm actually a professional magician, not musician. Everybody thinks I say musician, a professional magician. And when the pandemic hit, the last day of school for her was March 13th, Friday, March 13th. And we decided, at that point in my career, I was doing corporate magic shows for corporations and private parties, things like that. To me, I wasn't really a kid's magician. I didn't want to go there. So we decided, we looked at each other and she talked about all these poor students that were at home. They couldn't go because of the pandemic and it's virtual distance learning. And we decided to go on and do social media and do all these shows for kids because they needed to be entertained. And we designed, Life Lessons for Kids Through Magic. Life Lessons for Kids Through Magic. And I taught kids how to do magic, and I taught life lessons through these. And one thing ended up leading to another, and it just kind of took off, and we had a fantastic time with it. And it's not like I'm not some big famous magician at all. I'm just a working magician that's been able to make somewhat of a living, and we got to do school districts and just have the time of our life. And my wife, Debbie, is known as Pinky on stage, and she'll assist me on stage. We got to go to Las Vegas and perform, and we've done a lot of international conventions, and we've just, that's the kind of stuff I never dreamed of when I was out there drinking, the lifestyle we have today. And my mother, who got that intervention going for me, my mother, who was the one that had unconditional love for me my entire life, just like Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd go see her in the summertime, and Debbie would come with me, and we'd work on her house, and she was just always there for me. Anyway, we moved her out west a couple years ago when she was in an assisted living in Upland, California. That's about an hour and a half from where we live, and I'd go see her frequently, a couple times a week. And the pandemic hit, and she was starting to decline, and we had just seen her just before the pandemic hit, a couple days before, and she was declining. She was in bed. She was getting weak, and I could tell she was starting to, she no longer was interested in the things that used to interest her, like historic homes or plain bridge or Sudoku, all the things that she loved to do. She no longer found joy in those things. And we went to see her, and she's in bed, and we're sitting around her in bed, and I'm talking about food, the meals she used to make when we were kids and how much I loved her cooking and all the good times as kids growing up with my mom and my dad. And she was quiet, and I didn't know what to do. So the only thing I knew was, I started rubbing her feet. I started rubbing my mom's feet because there was nothing left to really talk about. She was so quiet. And I asked her if she could feel that and how it felt. And she goes, yeah. And I said, how does it feel? And she goes, it feels like love. So when the pandemic hit, we couldn't go see her. And those last couple of weeks, she passed away about 2 weeks into the pandemic. And I want to share this. How I just mentioned that there weren't things that brought her joy any longer? all the things that she had loved, she wasn't interested in. But there was one thing that still brought her joy and a spark in her eyes. And that one thing was other people. You know, when we went to visit her, she lit up. And relationships with others, I think, is the point I want to say. We can't stay sober by ourselves. It's all about the relationships that we develop with other people. When I'm closer to you guys, I feel closer to God. And it's because of the men and women in these meetings that were able to, that enabled me to have a closer relationship with my mother and be a son to her and to be a husband today and a happy, monogamous, continuous, long-term, loving relationship. And the last thing I'm going to say, I'm going to finish with this story. I know I got to wrap it up. The last thing I'm going to say is this story. A little girl goes to Europe on vacation with her parents. And while she's in Europe, they tour the great cathedrals. And while they're on tour through the great cathedrals, she asked the tour guide, who are the people in the stained glass windows? And the tour guide says, those are the saints. And when she gets home, she excitedly tells all her friends when she was in Europe, she got to see the saints. And when her friends ask her, who are the saints? She says, the saints are the ones who let the light in. And you guys are the saints in my life for letting the light in on my life. So thank you very much for being a part of my recovery. And thank you for having me tonight, Marty.
Please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays, plural, at pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ann P., and please don't forget your sponsor's name. Thank you.
Please email her by 6:30, or otherwise you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and tonight we have asked, dug deep in the well, paid big bucks for a birthday song from Beth P.
Coming back.
Awesome. Here's our birthdays for tonight. Our first birthday. What? I just lost the birthday list.
Hold on, Marty. It had an out of order issue here. Give me 2 seconds to straighten it out.
Wow, because I was going to say our first birthday is 45 years.
Yeah, ago. I know. Huh? That's something special. Three, almost there. Okay, looks good. Okay, sorry about that.
Our birthdays are... All right, there we go. Our first birthday tonight is for Brendan T. for 5 years, and his sponsor is Dave W. Second birthday is Kimmy B. for 2 years, and I'm going to say it's Julie W. is her sponsor.
I didn't do that.
Okay, they're a little bit out of order. Our third birthday is for Love B. for 10 years, and her sponsor is Linda L. We have a 30-year birthday for Joyce F., sponsored by Brenda W. We have a 36-year birthday for John K., sponsored by Tom B. And we have a 45-year birthday for a former secretary twice around for Pat Y., and her sponsor is Peg M. So we had 6 birthdays for 128 total years. The average is 21.33 years of sobriety. So welcome to all of our birthday recipients. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. And at the end of the year, this candle money is our contributions to AA World Services. If you'd like to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H. at treasurer. At pacificgroupla.org, and she'll give you avenues to contribute. underneath.